From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Viggo Mortensen is one of those actors who catches your eye and holds it when he's up on the big screen, whether he's playing the lead or not. Something about him doesn't quite conform. His face, his attitude, his body language. When his fists play tough, his eyes play kind, maybe even vulnerable. There's a little good in his bad guys, a little bad in his good guys. Now he's put aside the noble Aragorn of Lord of the Rings fame and his great Russian gangster Nikolai of Eastern Promises. In his latest film, he's Sigmund Freud, and the dust-ups are intellectual, psychoanalytical. No swords or horses, but a lot of cigars in Vienna. This hour on Point, we're talking with the singular actor, Viggo Mortensen. You can join the conversation. When did you first key in on this actor, Viggo Mortensen? Did he have you from Hobbit days, from the flanks of Mordor? Have you seen him simmer as Sigmund Freud in A Dangerous Method? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's just a little bit from the new film, A Dangerous Method. Viggo Mortensen as Sigmund Freud. Michael Fassbender is playing his protege here, Carl Jung. They're sitting in a cafe in Vienna. Sigmund, with his ever-present cigar, ponders what this new science is that he's created. Psychoanalysis. You can hear the excitement of the new and the mutual flattery.
Columbus, you know, had no idea what country he'd discovered. Like him, I'm in the dark. All I know is I've set foot on the shore, and the country exists.
I think of you more as Galileo, and your opponents as those who condemned him, while refusing even to put their eye to his telescope.
In any event, I've simply opened a door. It's for the young men like yourself to walk through it.
I'm sure you have many more doors to open for us.
Viggo Mortensen there, leading off, thinking about Christopher Columbus as Sigmund Freud in A Dangerous Method with Fassbender there as Carl Jung. Joining me now from New York, his birthplace, by the way, is actor, poet, painter, photographer, avant-garde musician Viggo Mortensen. He's got more than 30 movies under his belt, maybe 16 CDs of music and poetry, his own publishing house, and, as we'll learn this hour, he's got other irons in the fire, too. Viggo Mortensen, welcome. It's great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Tom.
We've seen you, interact a lot with swords and horses. The cigar is the central prop this time. You look very comfortable with it. How did you get that comfortable with the cigar?
It took me a little while, but fortunately I have good memories about the smell of good cigars. Fortunately, I had very good Cuban cigars to smoke in this movie, which is what Freud's preference was. My grandfather, Danish grandfather, he smoked cigars like Freud did. Freud smoked 20, 22 cigars a day.
Wow.
And I think my grandfather probably approximated that. I remember him as always having a cigar in his mouth and his house as smelling like cigars, the curtains, the kitchen, everywhere, the bathroom. it wasn't unpleasant. It took a little getting used to not inhaling and getting sick.
You know, you look very at home with it. Did you do a lot of practicing, I don't know, on the balcony at home?
Well, I had to get used to not just smoking them, but in looking at photographs in which almost inevitably Freud has a cigar either in his hand or in his mouth, mm-hmm. even when he's with children, doesn't matter what situation he's in. How did he hold them? How did he smoke them? And how do you speak in a way that, you can be understood with a big cigar in your mouth? That was something to work on. It was an interesting challenge.
You get it way back in the corner very often, I saw there, leaving a lot of the mouth available to speak what Freud has to say.
Yeah, well, I had to be also very precise with or without the cigar because he was, from what I researched, he was very eloquent. He was an engaging conversationalist. Before he became ill with cancer, he had a very powerful, mellifluous speaking voice and, as I say, very engaging. So I needed to be precise in terms of diction and I had to be understood.
and you do it. I think it's just, for my money, everybody's darn good in this, but I really like the way you bring Sigmund Freud across. And, it's interesting. We've seen you play so many different kinds of roles.
You're famous for doing very well at swordplay and very well at horsemanship, but this is really an intellectual kind of back and forth. You and Fassbender, you and, that is, Freud and Carl Jung, over the character played by Keira Knightley here, who starts out with some real emotional, psychological problems and then becomes a sort of the hinge between the two of you. For our listeners,
yeah, she did a wonderful job. She plays Sabina Spielrein, someone who audiences probably are not that familiar with, if at all, even in academic circles. She's sort of a forgotten pioneer. You know, hopefully this movie will give her credit for some of the great ideas she had, which Jung in particular borrowed freely from, and unfortunately did not give her credit. Freud gave her some credit in a footnote fashion, I guess, but and encouraged her to a degree. But she was a great thinker and did a lot of good work, in particular with child psychology. And she was, and I think that Keira does something akin to what we can remember the young Meryl Streep doing in, say, Sophie's Choice. I mean, in terms of the precision and the accent, the characterization, and the emotional courage of her role. I think that I know that it's been controversial for some critics. Some people have felt it was too uncomfortable, that she went too far. She's even been accused in some circles of overdoing it, overacting. But I think that it's a performance that will hold up, just as David Cronenberg's movies do. That each time you watch her performance in this movie, it'll get better. And you can't say that about many performances or movies, that they get better on repeated viewings.
You in the psychotic phase that she's portraying at the beginning of the film, it's sort of the lovely Keira Knightley's face as almost as presented by Picasso here. She's so distended and distraught. Yeah. I mean, she's really taking
it. She puts Gollum to shame.
Gollum to shame. No kidding. Do us a favor.
I wanted to say one thing before I forget. Being that I'm talking to you from New York City, my birthplace, and the fact that the New York Giants are in the playoff, I have to say that the only other time I was nominated for a Golden Globe Award, as I am fortunately this year for A Dangerous Method, the Giants went on to win the Super Bowl, which I kept saying to all the journalists, the Giants are going to win the Super Bowl. And they were like, yeah. And then there was that miraculous performance by Manning to take the Super Bowl. And I'm hoping I can be their good luck charm again.
Well, watch out. You've got all kinds of Tebow people and Tom Brady people and everybody else.
Yeah,
we know you're a sports
fans,
fan. I think you wore a hockey jersey under your Aragorn costume and chainmail the way back in Lord
Montreal
of the
Canadiens. They're not doing so well this
Sorry
year.
About that. Take us to the central intellectual conflict in A Dangerous Method, just the bones of it, between Freud and Jung here. For listeners who aren't plugged into that, Jung was Freud's protege, but they had the falling out. And describe for us where that rupture came.
Well, I mean, there were some academic differences. And, this movie, Christopher Hampton's beautiful script, which is based on the correspondence between not only Jung and Freud, but also with Sabina Spielrein, and on medical records, is very accurate historically and academically. But because it's a movie and it's not a documentary, one hopes to make a movie that's entertaining. And I think we did that by concentrating on the human side of these people, their weaknesses. You know, they were all these pioneers of psychoanalysis were very intelligent people, but also competitive, ambitious to make their mark, to leave their name in history. And I think that sometimes made them vulnerable, made them insecure to the point of being paranoid. And I think that it wasn't so much a question of academic differences of opinion. I think that Jung and Freud were not that far apart at that time. We're talking about pre-World War I. I think it was more a question of personality differences, differences in background, a question of pride, as often happens in not just in psychiatry or psychoanalysis, academic circles, it's often personal differences that create tension more than academic differences. And I think that was the case. When you're playing a character that, like Sigmund Freud or Jung or Spielrein, someone who of historical importance that people respect. You, as an actor, you can go down a blind alley if you place more importance on being profound than you would with any other character, whether it be comedy or drama or action movie. It can end up being dull, you know, not fun, and therefore not a good performance. And I think that we avoided that by allowing these people to be human. You know, Freud was a very intelligent person, a revolutionary thinker, but he was also a great artist. He thought of himself as an artist, and so did a lot of his colleagues.
Viggo Mortensen, can you hold it right there for just a moment?
Sure.
We've got a break coming up here. Of course, it's great to watch you as Freud, watching Jung as Jung goes down the supernatural or mythic path and a kind of somber disagreement right there. Viggo Mortensen with us. His new film is A Dangerous Method. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with actor-artist Viggo Mortensen. So many roles, Aragorn in Lord of the Rings, The Man in the Road, and now Sigmund Freud in David Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method. Sigmund Freud across from Carl Jung, taking it all back to a century ago when they were wading into psychoanalysis. In the new film, Jung's having an affair with his patient, Sabina Spielrein, beautiful young Russian woman played by Keira Knightley, who also becomes a psychiatrist herself in the course of the film. Here, out on Carl Jung's sailboat on Lake Zurich, Freud, Viggo Mortensen, confronts him with some rumors.
There's a rumor running around Vienna that you've taken one of your patients as a mistress.
It's absolutely untrue.
Well, of course it is. So I've been telling everyone.
What's being said?
I don't know. The woman's been bragging about it. That somebody's sending out anonymous letters. Usual sort of thing. Bound to happen sooner or later. It's an occupational hazard.
Yes. I hope I'd never be stupid enough to get emotionally involved with a patient.
Yes, but of course he was. and right up against that, here's Aragorn, noble son of Arathorn, is played by Viggo Mortensen in the third movie of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. He and his army are at the gates of evil Mordor here, inspiring his men before the final battle against Sauron and his forces of darkness.
An hour of wolves and shattered shields when the age of men comes crashing down. But it is not this day. This day we fight. By all that you hold dear on this good earth, I bid you stand, men of the West!
And it's Lord of the Rings territory. Viggo Mortensen joins us from New York City. Viggo, lots of people looking to speak with you. Lucius in Franklin, Tennessee. Lucius, you're on the air with Viggo Mortensen.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Viggo, it's...
Hey, Lucius.
How you doing, brother? It's a pleasure. This is my first time talking with an actor.
Oh, wow. Well, thanks for calling.
I saw Witness about several, of course, I think back in the 80s. And, of course, now, just in 2000, I guess about a year or two ago, I said, man, it looked like Viggo Mortensen. And I played it back and played it back. I says, my goodness, that is him. And when I first saw it, I did not recognize you.
This is with Harrison Ford, way back when.
And how old were you at the time?
I probably looked like I was about 16, but I was, let's see, I was about 26 or so, 27. And that was the first movie that I did, speaking part, where I actually wasn't cut out of the movie afterwards. In fact, the part got bigger. I had an interesting choice. It was sort of a crossroads when I got that part. Well, Peter Weir directed Witness. And
you were a young Amish farmer there, Harrison Ford.
Yeah, I was offered that part. And at the same time, I was living in New York, I was offered Shakespeare in the Park, a role in, I think it was Henry V.
Oh.
And I wanted to do the play, but I was advised to try the movie. It wasn't very often that you get a chance to be in a movie. I can do a play some other time. Mm. And so I chose to do that. It was a day's work. And then when I got there, Peter Weir looked at me and said, well, you could be Alexander Goodenough's brother, the Amish, the blonde Amish suitor to Kelly McGillis and rival for her affections with Harrison Ford. So I ended up being given the role of his brother and sort of tagged along. It was kind of fun.
Wow. Well, I was very fortunate to major in Bible, and I did have to take psychology, and I came across Sigmund Freud back in the mid-80s, and man, of course, seeing your body of work, and it's superb. How did you come across that role of Sigmund Freud?
Well, David Cronenberg, I'd worked with in History of Violence and Eastern Promises, and he offered me the role of Sigmund Freud the year before they actually shot this movie, A Dangerous Method, and I wasn't available at the time, but I was sort of puzzled by it. I said, really? You sure? I'm right for that guy? And he said, oh, yeah. But anyway, I couldn't do it, and they cast someone else, and that actor, in the end, sort of last minute, decided to leave and go do a bigger budget production studio movie.
This was Christopher Waltz going off to Water for Elephants.
Yeah, Christoph Waltz,
who
had just won a Best Supporting Actor Award for his work in Inglourious Basterds, Tarantino movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my luck that David then got a hold of me again. And, I mean, we talk a lot. We're good friends. And he said, listen, do you have time now? Because I really would like you to do this. And I thought, and I said, well, I do have time, and you're sure about this? And he goes, yeah. And, you know, I know he's the last person that wants to miscast his movie. He's not going to give me a part just as a favor. It would be dangerous to do something like that, and he would never do it. So I said yes, and I'm glad I did. Another director had offered me that, the role of Sigmund Freud. I might have turned it down because it just seemed like such a stretch. And it was, you know, in terms of the look of the character and the way he spoke and everything. But it was a great challenge, and I think a lot of times the things that look impossible, really difficult, where you really sweat it and are very, very unsure of how to go about it at first, those are the parts or the challenges in life that you remember the most, the tough ones, you know. How did you get through that?
Well, you certainly got it here. I mean, you slick the hair back, grow the beard, get the cigar, get that tremendous gravity going, and you've got some way of doing that, which is really interesting to me. Lucius, I appreciate your call.
Thanks, Lucius.
Viggo, I wonder, you know, what you've got this really unusual background, Danish father and all that, a lot of time as a kid in Argentina, Latin America. Mm-hmm. Is it that upbringing and parentage breathing through you that makes you somehow a different cat on the screen? Is it something you're doing deliberately, or do you think it's just in you from your upbringing?
I don't know. I think that an itinerant childhood is not uncommon among actors, you know, moving a lot from place to place. And
your dad was in chicken farming and I don't know what all, agriculture.
Yeah, among other things. Mm-hmm. But having, you know, learning more than one language, moving around a lot as a kid does help you look at the world from the point of view of different cultures. And I think maybe that helps. I mean, as an actor, in my opinion, what you're trying to do is look at the world from points of view sometimes quite different than your own. Finding a way to make it your own or to invest yourself in it without judging the character. And maybe, I don't know. I mean, I think that you made a comment earlier about trying to find the good in someone who's written as bad or the bad in someone who's written as good. You know, I don't think things are black and white with any person, no matter what walk of life they come from, what part of the world they come from, what age, what sex. I think that, you know, people are complicated, and that's what makes them interesting. So I'm always looking for what's not written. With Freud, you know, and doing the research, something that wasn't obvious in the script, I mean, there's no out-and-out jokes or anything, I was happy to find that Freud was renowned for his sense of humor.
Oh, when we saw it, and you're very wry, but very much there.
Yeah, there's an ironic tone there, and mm-hmm. and that comes from, you know, his reading, for example. He loved Mark Twain for his satire. Mm-hmm. He loved Oscar Wilde, and he loved, you know, Austrian humorists who were, you know, I mean, he was capable of saying something extremely profound in a very light conversational way, but he could also say something like, time spent with cats is never wasted.
You know, I mean, right.
He had this sort of wry sense of humor.
Right. I mean, those complications of character make it in a character, in a fiction. Complications
of devils in the details.
Devils in the details. No. I mean, your details, though, are sort of really interesting here. Here we're looking back, I don't know, a year ago or so, you're knighted by the Queen of Denmark.
That was something.
That's something.
I was very nervous.
Are you a dual nervous. Citizen? And I wonder about your character, nationality, sense of self. Where are you planted, or are you?
It's confusing sometimes, to be honest with you. But yeah, I'm a dual citizen, Danish and American, and I've lived and worked in Denmark and speak the language, and mm-hmm. and so to be. I mean, I'm not a great fan of monarchy in general, mm-hmm. but I have to say that the royal house in Denmark is closer to the people than, say, the English one. It's less stuffy. You know, she walks the streets. She's someone who went to university, studied archaeology.
Did she put a sword on your shoulder to do this knighting business?
No, it was went into this, into the palace, mm-hmm. and then you're led into this imposing, gigantic room, and she's sitting in this chair. In the middle of it. It was, you know, incredible and scary. But the thing that was beautiful about it is that you wait your turn. The few who are knighted each year, they go in one by one, and then they say to you before you go in, you know, there's a certain dress code and all that, obviously, mm-hmm. but they say, when you go in, you'll be alone with the queen. There are no microphones, no cameras. You can say whatever you want. Mm-hmm. It's just you and her.
That's
Nobody
great.
Will know what was said. And that was a really interesting experience for me.
Did you have much of a conversation in the middle of this great room with the Queen of Denmark?
It wasn't very long. I don't mm-hmm. think those things tend to be very long, and I think she's very patient with people who obviously walk in and are quite nervous like mm-hmm. I was. I was much more nervous, even though I had met her before when we had the premiere for The Return of the King. The whole royal family turned mm-hmm. out for the first time ever to that, and that was interesting. But this situation made me quite nervous, and she was very friendly, very kind, but she had an exhibition, a photo exhibition on at a museum, and well, to do with her archaeology mm-hmm. career, and I talked to her about that a little bit, and but I didn't really know much else. You know, I didn't know what to say, really. It was just kind of... as much as you know,
it's formal. It's the act itself.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it's sort of ridiculous, really, you know, the whole thing of kings and queens.
Yes.
But, you know, there I was, and I was completely swept up by it and very, very anxious and relieved to leave the room, actually, without having been beheaded or something.
Viggo Mortensen is with us. So many films, great films. His latest is A Dangerous Method. Tom is calling from Jackson, North Carolina. Tom, you're on the air with Viggo Mortensen.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Vegan. How are you guys doing?
Well.
Pretty good.
Good. Sigmund Freud once said that the only people impervious to psychoanalysis are the Irish, and I just wanted to get your opinion. Do you think that Lord Aragon of Gondor would be impervious to psychoanalysis?
I don't know. He did a lot of soul searching, you know. He didn't have a shrink, but he considered his actions, and some at times in that story, if you'll recall, thought him to be weak because he mm-hmm. tried to weigh his actions. He didn't take exercising violence lightly. He cared about people, and he had insecurities. I mean, I tried with that character to make him as human as I could, just as I did with Sigmund Freud. I can only say what I think about psychoanalysis. I think, in principle, the idea of being free to speak in total confidence about your most profound fears, desires, insecurities with someone who's not going to go talk about it with anybody else, who's not going to judge you, is not a bad idea at all. Mm-hmm. If you feel it's necessary, I think it's certainly good. Now, it depends, you know. It's like any the chemistry of any relationship, doctor-patient. Sometimes it doesn't work out well. It's not the right fit. But the the idea in principle, I think, is not a bad one. I don't think it would have hurt Aragorn. You know, in a way, he had Galadriel, and I suppose he had Elrond, although he was a bit strict, to talk to. And he certainly had, you know, the character Sean Bean played, Boromir, the other human. He had him to talk to and to be listened to by. But unfortunately, he dies after the first one, so the second and third part of the trilogy
on his own.
On his own. Yeah, hey, just him and his horse.
I read, Viggo, that when Lord of the Rings was first brought to you, you weren't really interested in, and then it was your, what, your son, now in his 20s, and then maybe, I don't know, 11 or 12,
11,
who was aware of it and talked you into it. What was his argument for you, Dad?
Well, I had just finished shooting, actually in North Carolina, a movie, and I played a baseball player in a drug rehab movie, and I loved working there in Western North Carolina near Asheville, where we filmed.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. And springtime. And, you know, I'd just gotten back, and then I took a long road trip with my son. He was 11 at the time, as I say, and he drew a map by hand of the United States. And I said, well, now tell us where you want to go. He says, well, I want to go see our friends in Arizona and New Mexico. I'd like to go see, Elvis's house in Memphis. I'd like to go to Chicago. You know, so it was this zigzag. So instead of going across the country, we spent, I don't know, a month and a half driving, which was a great, great experience. And when we got home, the school year started and so forth. And suddenly I got this call. And they said, well, and I said, well, I had to replace, again, to replace an actor. They were already shooting. I felt it was I don't know. I hadn't read the books, and I didn't feel I was up for it. And they said, no, we think you can do it. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but I just finished a long job, and I don't know. You know, they said, well, you'll be done by Christmas. I go, oh, really? And they said, of next year.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, well, no, I can't. I don't want to be away from my son that long. But then I hung up, and he said, are you crazy? Is that Lord of the Rings they're talking about? And they said, what character? And I said, I don't know, this guy, Walker? He said, Strider. I said, yeah, Strider. And he says, well, he's the king. Then he becomes a king. You got to do that, you know, so forth. So that had something to do with it. I probably would have done it anyway, because I would have felt like I would have always asked myself if it, you know, if I hadn't been a coward, you know, if I'd said no. So I might have done it anyway, but certainly my son weighing in made a difference.
Well, look at that and much more. Viggo Mortensen is with us, actor, artist, man of parts. I mean, poet, we'll hear a little bit of that. Pianist, we'll have a little bit of that just coming up here. And photographer, right across the board, his new film is A Dangerous Method. He's portraying Sigmund Freud, Austrian psychiatrist Sigmund Freud, way back a century ago when he's in a kind of a big conversation with Carl Jung about psychoanalysis and human nature. Viggo Mortensen, please stand by there, New York. It's so great to have you with us. We're going to go out hearing a little bit of you, your music. This is, we'll go out on Gone. This is from the 2003 CD Pandemonium from America. It's a collaboration. Viggo Mortensen on piano with avant-garde guitarist Buckethead. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with actor-artist Viggo Mortensen, Aragorn in Lord of the Rings, now Sigmund Freud in David Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method, just out in November and still in theaters. Such a range of performances he's given over the years, and then it doesn't end there. We'll hear that, but here's a little bit from terrific movie, Eastern Promises. This is 2007. Mortensen plays a tough guy, Nikolai, who does the dirty work for the Russian mafia in London. Here a man has just been killed in a barbershop in Vigo. Well, Nikolai strips his corpse of identifying features before disposing of it.
Have you finished cutting his hair?
Better burn wallet.
Okay. Now I'm going to do his teeth and cut off his fingers. You might want to leave room.
Viggo Mortensen as Russian tough guy. Here he is playing the father in the 09 post-apocalyptic movie The Road. Here he is reflecting many years later on the moment the world as he'd known it ended.
The clock stopped at 1:17. There was a long sheer of bright light. Then a series of low concussions. I think it's October, but I can't be sure. I haven't kept a calendar for years.
And it's not just movies, painting, photography, politics, poetry. Here's a poem called Waiting off Viggo Mortensen's spoken work album, Recent Forgeries. This was released in 1998.
Pieces of you drift by in the dead of the afternoon on the yellow tip of a wave. The same shark that came to shore at the end of yesterday rolls sickly, bumping coral like a tired drunk to avoid being eaten at low tide.
Viggo Mortensen voicing there his own poetry. Lots of callers for you, Viggo. Mary in Boston, you're on the air with Viggo Mortensen.
Hi, thank you so much. I have always enjoyed your films in Hollywood, but I have to tell you, you really genuinely earned my respect when I was lucky enough to attend the taping of The People Speak in Boston, where you gave voice to a couple of different sources that Howard Zinn used in his work. And I was so impressed to hear you speak in Spanish as de las Casas, and then later as the father of a 9/11 victim. And your work has actually made my work as a history teacher in Andover, Mass, so much easier. You've brought life to some historical figures, and it feels like you're doing that again. So I genuinely appreciate your ability to do that, and my students have come to understand history a little bit better through that work that you've done. So thank you, and again, I appreciate you doing it again with Froy.
Well, thank you very much for the compliment. That was a great taping. It was 3 days in a theater in Boston, and Howard Zinn's book and his lifetime of great work is very important. And he, like you as a history teacher, I'm sure, are aware, he was tireless in making sure that people kept in mind, the adage, if you forget history, you're doomed to repeat it. And that's part of the fun. I mean, it's interesting to go back in time, whether it be Sigmund Freud or other historical figures, to find out. I mean, people have learned things along the way long before we came to this world, and it's worth remembering those things, their warnings, their clear thinking, you know. It's people are often in a great hurry, you know, and always feel like this time is the best time, and, you know, we're on the verge of great things, and nobody is smarter than we are, more advanced than we are. But we often forget important ideas, important values from the past if we're not careful.
That movie, The People Speak, Howard Zinn's, of course, produced by Matt Damon when he was still alive. Howard Zinn, a very welcome presence at this table in this studio that we're speaking to you from today, Viggo. I mean, that, of course, people's history, the United States, his, and much more, a great guy. That learning you're talking about, I mean, it intersects with politics in the real world very often. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it that you've learned along the way that took you to back Denis Kucinich when he ran for president, took you to support Cindy Sheehan driving out to sort of give her a pat on the back the highway?
Cindy Sheehan and Denis Kucinich, and unfortunately very few others in the United States, what I respect most about them is that they are not only well-informed and courageous, that they speak truth to power, that they talk about the things that are important. This morning on a TV show, I saw something unusual. I saw Cornel West and Tavis Smiley being interviewed, and they were talking about things that politicians, including, you know, Barack Obama, don't talk about, words they don't use, poverty, you know, for example. You would think
that would not be hard to voice in this time.
A phrase I probably overuse is what else? So what else? You know, whether it's playing a character, what else is there to it other than what's written in the script, other than what people have said to me about this character I'm about to play? What else is going on other than what they're talking about in the political campaign? And it's all well and good to say, you know, we have to save America, or, you know, this is our last chance to turn this thing around. What does that mean? You know, we have to cut out fraud and corruption, and we have to be strict, and we have to take some hard measures. And there's a lot of talk about firing and the benefits of firing people. Well, who should be fired, and who's getting away with murder? You know, I'm curious about these questions.
Cindy Sheehan lost her son in Iraq and spoke out against the Iraq War. Yeah. She was, I think, camped out near George W. Bush's ranch in Texas when you drove up to give her some support. Did she know who you
just
were?
Just to have a conversation with him, and he was too cowardly to do so. He never did talk to her. And she just wanted to ask, as a mom, what's going on? What's the war for? Mm-hmm. I think history has already proven to us that the war in Iraq was, what was that about? How was that any more important, which is to say, not at all, really, in terms of U.S. security, than the war, the Korean War, or the Vietnam War, you know? And I know I'm getting into, you know, some people, this is nothing against the military or anything. I think it's ironic that, you know, our Defense Department, that's an ironic name. It's almost always for offense, it seems. You know, we spend twice as much money on weaponry as the rest of the world combined. I mean, asking questions about that, which Barack Obama's not going to touch that. Asking questions about the unfair tax structure in this country, asking those sorts of questions, the unmentionable subjects, that's what interests me. And I think that's what interested Sigmund Freud as well, you know. And I think you see a little bit of that in A Dangerous Method. He's wanting to talk about the body. He's wanting to talk about what women feel and desire.
Sexuality.
Things that at the time people didn't want to talk about. It. Carl Jung, as you see in the movie, you're saying, well, why are you so obsessed with sex, basically? Why does everything, why do you have to call it, talk about penises and, you know, rectums and desires and, you know, what happens between men? Why does it, you have to always talk about that? And, you know, can't we give it another name? And Freud's answer simply was, why?
Why he gives him that long gaze and say that it is what is.
It is what it is. And if you don't talk about things that you're afraid of or that you're uncomfortable with, that are nevertheless in your mind all the time and maybe eating away at you, those things will come out later, maybe in a more destructive way toward others or toward yourself, and it's better to talk about them. There's an interesting difference between them. There's a difference, I think, between helping and curing. Jung felt that he was going to cure people. He famously said, you know, as a sort of a joke, but it was quite telling. He said, "Show me a sane man, and I will cure him," which I think is a little bit arrogant. You know, I mean, all these guys were somewhat arrogant.
Yes.
And I think he felt that he was going to cure people. And Freud said, "No, we're not going to cure anybody. Mm-hmm. That's not the goal. The goal is awareness, for people to be aware of what's going on inside them, to be able to talk about it rather than repress it." You know. So anyway, I'm interested in general in life. I feel life is short. We don't really know what comes after, if anything. And I just like to take part and observe as an artist and as a person, whether it be politics, nature, art, technology, science, as far as I can understand it. Why do things happen? Why are people concerned with certain things? Why are certain subjects not allowed in a political campaign? You know, obviously money is involved. You know, there are campaign donors that wouldn't want you speaking about certain things. Dennis Kucinich is probably our greatest congressman, you know, certainly of my time. He's somebody who spoke truth to power always. He's when the Patriot Act came up for the vote, he was the lone voice saying, no, this is not a good idea for our country. And people said, why? You know, why? It sounds treasonous. He says, because I read it. What about you guys? Yeah, and there was silence. Nobody else in Congress had read the thing. You know, same with the Iraq War. He said, who's really looked into this? This is not a good idea. He was one of the few voices that spoke out against it, and he was called a traitor and every other thing. You know, go move to France if you don't like it here kind of thing. Yeah. And that I think that's those people, those few people, Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, you know, Dennis Kucinich, people like that who make you think, Cornel West, are worth their weight in gold. It's often not until they're gone. Mark Twain in his time was politically very active. It's their ideas, unfortunately, are heated too late often, but they're there and they don't give up. They're an example. Howard Zinn was someone who never quit. Mm-hmm. In his gentle way, reminding people of the political realities, you know?
Very true. Very true. And at this table, Carrie in Nelson County, Virginia. You're on the air with Viggo Mortensen.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hello, Mr. Mortensen.
Hello there.
I just had a question for you. I know in The Lord of the Rings, at the last in the last movie, your character sings, and also in Hidalgo, and in G.I. Jane, your character reads a poem, and my question was, were those parts written for you, like the people knew
the
they had those interests and they created that opportunity for you, or were they already in the script?
Well, the singing in Lord of the Rings at the coronation was something that was in the book, and I suggested to Peter Jackson that we use that. That was an important. He's repeating the song that his forefathers, you know, the words that his forefathers sung, according to Tolkien, in Elvish, upon coming to those same shores of, you know, Middle Earth from across the sea. And I said, well, you know, we should do it. And I came up with a melody which they liked and sang it a cappella, as you hear it in the movie. And you know, I wouldn't say that I'm a great singer or anything at all. But I enjoy it, and I think that, you know, in you know, centuries ago, poetry was sung generally, not just in Ireland, but in all over the world, and still is in a lot of places. And it's interesting. You know, song sometimes brings out certain emotions that just speaking doesn't. For example, I just finished doing an Ariel Dorfman play in Madrid, a very difficult play based on the Jason and Medea myth. It's a play called Purgatorio. And there's a section that's very lyrical where the character I play is for once being really honest and very vulnerable and speaking about how his love for his woman. And one night, about halfway through the run of performances, I sang, you know, about a paragraph. I don't know why.
It just as opposed to simple speech.
Just speaking it, sort of to the audience. And I sang it, and then I looked over at the actress, the great actress, Carmen Elias, who was playing with me, and she looked sort of surprised, but it felt right, you know. And then the next night she said, well, you're going to do it tonight. I said, I don't know. I can't remember the melody. I just made it up.
Did it have a Spanish feel to it, your impromptu melody?
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. And, well, it was in Spanish, the play. And so then it took me two or three nights to kind of figure out what the melody had been, so I sounded probably terrible for a few nights. But there was a vulnerability to making the attempt that really helped, you know. So sometimes singing or a certain musical, it doesn't have to be outright song sometimes. Sometimes it's just a musicality. And singing sometimes helps loosen the voice, loosen your emotions. With Freud, you know, I would sing just to get ready, you know, before shooting sometimes, just to kind of feel, to get that the tone I wanted, you know, the irony and the playfulness that Freud was reputed to have.
I saw, when he spoke with people. If I may, I saw a little somehow, can I say, loneliness in your depiction of Freud. Is that Freud? Your reading of him is that you, after all your travels? What is that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, I think that Freud, you know, his humor and his wit, rather, which is a bit sharper than humor. There's a certain self-protective quality to that sort of humor, wit, as opposed to just joke telling.
Bonhomie.
I think a lot of it was, you know, to cover his certain nervousness sometimes, certain insecurities that he had, you know, his attempt, you know, his gifts as a conversationalist, expressing himself so well, engaging people, being generous with his ideas, saying, you know, these are not my ideas, these are for anyone to use, and so forth, in some way covered certain insecurities. You know, he was a very gregarious person, a family man, comfortable in social situations, mm-hmm. it would seem. But underneath that, I think there was a nervousness, a tension. You know, let's not forget that he was Jewish in a time where there was a rampant anti-Semitism, yes. in Austria, mm-hmm. and in Europe in general. And he was fearful of his pioneering work in psychoanalysis being derided, which it was, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Not just in Europe, but in North America at the time. You know, it was considered by many a pseudoscience, this psychoanalysis, a bourgeois thing just for middle-class Jews, urban Jews. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, you know, a very anti-Semitic kind of look from some people at this science. And that was part of the reason that Freud was so interested in enlisting Jung, who
yes.
was Aryan, yes, who was right. a Lutheran, son of Lutheran pastor, from a long line of pastors, and a quite different person. And that's what attracted him. He thought this is good for the movement, apart from the fact that Jung is brilliant, young mind and all that. It was helpful to broaden the appeal of psychoanalysis.
And they brought it to the world. Viggo Mortensen is in A Dangerous Mind as Sigmund Freud, a little theme from the movie behind us right here. Viggo Mortensen, absolutely wonderful speaking with you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your time, and I thank your listeners for listening to us.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.